In our series on the ministry of the marketplace, we come today to perhaps the most familiar of all the Bible characters we are going to be examining, and that's the man Belteshazzar, better known by his Hebrew name, Daniel, and his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, strangely better known by their Babylonian names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. If you know any Bible stories at all, you probably know the stories of these men. But familiarity must not be allowed to breed contempt toward the wonderful biblical principles that are offered through these lives for our careers and our daily work. Daniel is often thought of as a prophet, but he was never more than a part-time prophet. When we read his story in the book of Daniel, we find him first as a hostage of war, and then as a member of the civil service in Babylon that is assigned to the king's service, then a ruler over the province of Babylon, then the third highest official in the entire Babylonian Empire, and finally as a very high official in the Medo-Persian Empire that followed the Babylonian. In total, Daniel was a successful government worker for over 70 years. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were taken hostage by the Babylonians at the same time that Daniel was. And they too entered government service. And they were promoted in the province of Babylon after their experience in the fiery furnace. And we aren't given any further details about their career. I'm just curious this morning how many government workers we have here. Someone who works for the federal government or the state government or the local government or the post office, the civil service. How many? Would you just raise your hands so we can see? And we had more in the first service than in the second service. But whether you work for the government or involved in any other kind of employment, the story of these men has tremendous impact, I think. I've entitled my message today, Daniel and the Three Hebrew Young Men. Courage and character come before career. These two qualities, courage and godly character, seem to stand out in four major scenes in these men's lives. The message, I think, is clear that their success is a gift from God, but it was also related to the way they demonstrated courage and character as they went through their daily experiences in the marketplace. So let's start with scene one, hostages in a foreign land. When Nebuchadnezzar first came against Jerusalem, he took hostages, not in order to torture them or kill them, but to bring them into his own administration. He wanted the cream of the crop of Jewish young men, men who were old enough to make the adjustment psychologically to a new land, and yet young enough to learn easily and to come to feel at home in this Babylonian culture. Older teens seemed to be the best target. To the best of our knowledge, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego never saw their homeland again. What is clear is that these were exceptional young men who were taken hostage, all the Hebrew hostages. Let's begin our reading in Daniel chapter 1. And I just encourage you to keep your Bible open this morning because we're going to be reading several sections. I'm going to start with chapter 1, verse 3. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. Now, all the hostages were exceptional. Physically, intellectually, socially, psychologically. But these four men, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, were exceptional also spiritually speaking. This comes out in verse 8, where Daniel is mentioned, but the other three are included in the story as well. It says, Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. And he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel. But the official told Daniel, I am afraid of my Lord the King who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you. Daniel then said to the guard, whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. Now, why would the king's food defile them? I think there are several possible reasons. One is that he could have been giving them unclean food. That is, food that wasn't kosher, that Israelites weren't supposed to eat. Pork, perhaps, or shellfish. I think also this food was likely offered to Babylonian idols, for that was typically done at that time. To refuse this diet must have taken tremendous courage. The quality of the food, I suspect, was of very high quality and certainly more attractive than vegetables and water. And to not eat it was to spoil any chances of advancement that they might have, because King Nebuchadnezzar himself had assigned the diet, according to verse 10. Furthermore, just like Joseph, these young men must have been gravely tempted to violate their conscience. After all, they were a long way from home, and no one would know. Furthermore, God had not protected them from being taken hostage, so what did they owe to Him? Besides, diet seems like such a relatively small thing, so why not just blow that off? And finally, Daniel's first request to be exempted was not granted. And so he could have said, well, I try. We have to go ahead. And instead, he approaches the official who told him no with a creative alternative, which was eventually accepted on a trial basis. The creative alternative produces an amazing result. The four Hebrews appear healthier and better nourished than all the others. And so they enter the king's service in verse 19, because the king can find no one equal to them. They are assigned to a branch of the intelligence service with the wise men and the magicians that were to give the king advice on affairs of state. It says in verse 20, in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in the whole kingdom. This is no accident, and I dare say it's not because of their vegetarian diet, which is healthy, but it wouldn't produce this result. It specifically states in verse 17 where this tremendous knowledge came from. It says, to these four young men God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. But I think clearly implied is that the decision that they took not to defile themselves was a decision that God honored by blessing them. Courage and character, they believed, come before career. Now, scene number 2 involves Daniel's next job as ruler over the province of Babylon. This portion of the story focuses particularly on and Daniel and the other three friends aren't mentioned till the very end of the story. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream which troubles him greatly. And he goes to the wise men for an interpretation. But so troubled was he by this dream that he wanted to be absolutely certain that the wise men of Babylon weren't just blowing smoke when they gave him an interpretation. So he said, "I want you to tell me what the dream is, and then I'll know if you're right, and then I can trust your interpretation." No room for shenanigans here. Their response is quite understandable. We read it in chapter 2 and verse 10. They say, "There is not a man on earth who can do what the king asks. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among men." Share something interesting about their perspective of Babylonian religion, isn't it? Their gods don't live among them. Nebuchadnezzar isn't very happy about this response. And he overreacts just a little. He decides to kill them all. And this is not beyond Nebuchadnezzar from what we know about him from secular history. But when Daniel hears that the wise men are all going to die, and he knows that he and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are all members of the wise men's guild, he asks for 24 hours to discern the dream and interpret it. And then he prays, and God answers that prayer. We don't have time this morning to talk about the dream, but Nebuchadnezzar was quite impressed when Daniel revealed it and then interpreted it. It says in chapter 2, in verse 46, "Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell prostrate before Daniel and paid him honor and ordered that an offering and incense be presented to him. The king said to Daniel, 'Surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery.' Then the king placed Daniel in a high position and lavished many gifts on him. He made him ruler over the entire province of Babylon and placed him in charge of all its wise men. Moreover, at Daniel's request, the king appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego administrators over the province of Babylon, while Daniel himself remained at the royal court." Once again, we find Daniel exercising tremendous courage here. He shows courage in challenging the king's decree to put the wise men to death. Courage in assuming that God would reveal the dream to him and allow him to interpret it. Courage in going before Nebuchadnezzar with that information, knowing that if any of the dream is wrong, he will face certain death, possibly even torture. And God rewards Daniel. He causes Daniel to become ruler over the province of Babylon. He gives him great wealth. He gives him authority over the other wise men. And he even looks with favor on Daniel's three friends. Once again, Daniel puts courage and character before his career, and God blesses him for it. Scene 3 finds Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego promoted in the province of Babylon. There's no greater example of courage and character in the entire Bible, other than perhaps Jesus going to the cross, than we find right here in Daniel chapter 3. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are the focus now, rather than Daniel himself. The story, of course, is familiar to every student of the Bible. King Nebuchadnezzar makes a gold image, 9 stories high. Can you just imagine that thing gleaming there in the sunshine? We don't read about this image in secular history, but we do read that Nebuchadnezzar did some amazing building projects, and he had the Hanging Gardens of Babylon built, for example, for his wife who had come from another part of the world and missed the gardens that were there. So he incorporated those gardens right there in the desert in Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar went on some amazing ego trips, which make this incident seem quite likely. Everyone in Babylon bows down to this 90-foot gold image, except for three individuals, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, Daniel isn't mentioned in this story, so I would assume he was on a trip out of the country for the king or something. What we know about Daniel, he certainly wouldn't have bowed down either. He just isn't mentioned in the story. Some of the fellow wise men who were already jealous because these three had gotten special favors from the government, decide to turn in these three and report their insubordination to Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar gives them a second chance. That's not like him. I suppose he did it out of deference to Daniel, or maybe because they had done such tremendous work. But we read in chapter 3, beginning in verse 13, furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? Now when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good, I'll overlook the whole thing. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand?" Their response to Nebuchadnezzar is classic courage. And one of my favorite chapters or passages in all of the Bible, it says in verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown in the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." I want to ask you and ask myself, how many of us are willing to say, "Our God is able, and he will, but even if he does not, I will still do the right thing or refrain from the wrong thing"? Young people, how many of you are willing to say, "My God is able to help me pass this test, even if I do not cheat like all my friends are doing, but even if he does not, I will not cheat"? How many of you businessmen will say, "My God is able to give me a promotion, even if I don't cook the books like my boss is asking me to do, but even if he does not, I will not cook the books"? How many of you ladies with small children are willing to say, "God is able to keep us out of debt, even if I do not go and get a job and put my kids in daycare all day long, but even if he does not, my children are too important to do that"? God does rescue these three young men, as you well know. And they walk out of that furnace unscathed, not even the smell of smoke on them. And the furnace was so hot that the men who threw them in the furnace were totally consumed by it. And Nebuchadnezzar speaks profound truth when he says in verse 28, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own. Of course, he misses one point. Yahweh isn't just the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He's the only God. And Nebuchadnezzar won't learn that for a while yet. This vignette concludes in verse 30, where we are told, "Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon." This is the last thing we read about these men. We don't have any further information about their lives, but we know enough to know that courage and character were part of their spiritual DNA. You know, I doubt if any of us here today will ever be asked to risk what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego risked for their lives, for their faith, I should say. But it's not impossible, you know. There have been more martyrs for the Christian faith than the last century than in any century in history before that. I was looking on the Voice of the Martyrs website this week and found a little story about, let me read it to you. On October the 2nd, this was 3 weeks ago, tomorrow, at 2:30 p.m., Lorenz Wagiel Emil, a 15-year-old Christian girl, and here's her picture, was kidnapped from a public bus by Muslims in the Egyptian city of El Mahalla al-Kobra, about 60 miles north of Cairo. The abductors were trying to force Lorenz, a student of Saida Nafesa High School, to deny Christ and accept Islam. Her father received the following text messages during the abduction. "The girl is not accepting easily, but she will embrace Islam for sure. Take the rest of your daughters and leave the city, or you will lose them one by one." The Emil family gathered at the police station, pleading with the officers to arrest a certain Muslim man they suspected of the kidnapping. However, the teen managed to escape from her Muslim captors, who drugged and threatened to rape her. While the terrorists were taking a break from a Ramadan fast, she broke out of her detention room located in Helwan, a suburb just south of Cairo. Prior to allowing her to reunite with her family, however, state security investigation officials told Lorenz that if she did not deny that the kidnapping had taken place, she would never see her parents again. The kidnapping of Christian teenage girls in Muslim nations has reached into the thousands. Many are forced through physical violence to convert to Islam. Other girls are often lured into becoming Muslims with promises of material wealth. The Voice of the Martyrs sponsors safe houses in Islamic countries to protect Christian teenage girls who have been threatened with or have escaped from abduction. You know, the relatively minor opposition we face for our faith, I would just call it inconvenience, gives us all the more reason why we should exhibit courage and character in the marketplace. Friends, God calls us to that. Now, we can't leave the book of Daniel without touching upon one more scene, again, one that you are very familiar with, but it also shows these qualities of courage and character. As Daniel, one of the three vice presidents of the Medo-Persian Empire, prospers even further under Darius and Cyrus. Daniel 6 is probably the best known story in the entire Bible, that of Daniel in the lion's den. I'll mention only a few highlights of the story, but I want to have you get the historical setting well in your mind. The time lapse between the fiery furnace and the lion's den is many, many decades, perhaps over 50 years. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were all taken captive back in 605 BC, which is the starting point of the 70-year captivity of Israel to Babylon. Chapter 5 and verse 32 marks the end of that 70-year captivity. It says there, "That very night, the night of the handwriting on the wall, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. If Daniel was a teenager when he was taken captive in 605, now in 539 BC, he's in his upper 80s. At the start of chapter 6, the Babylonian Empire is finished, and the Medo-Persian Empire has begun. But Daniel is the same person, still a man of courage, still a man of character. Look at chapter 6, and I want us to read a few verses at the beginning of this chapter. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. Just stop there for a moment and think about how many administrations borrow people from the previous administrations in high positions. It almost never happens. They want their own cronies in office. Well, this happens because Daniel is a man of character, a man of integrity, a man of reputation, trustworthiness. It goes on to say the satraps were made accountable to those three administrators so that the king might not suffer loss. Now, Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They couldn't find one thing in his expense report that was questionable. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has something to do with the law of his God." I dearly love that last sentence. But please understand that his enemies are not suggesting that they will be able to find any legitimate charges against him regarding his faith. They're actually going to use his consistency against him. They are going to exploit the fact they know Daniel won't change in his commitment to God. They are also interested in exploiting a unique provision in Persian law that says that certain laws signed by the king could not be repealed. And they are also willing to exploit this king's monstrous ego. Well, you know the story. How they convinced the king to issue a decree that if anyone prays to any other god than himself for 30 days, they will be thrown into a lion's den. And how Daniel went home, and it says, as was his custom, he knelt down before an open window facing Jerusalem, and he prayed. Every one of us here in this room today would be tempted to at least pray in a different place. To at the very least pray in a different manner. Maybe pray while driving our chariot home from the office with our eyes open. Something to avoid this terrible threat. We would excuse ourselves on the basis that dead men can't serve God. And we want to serve God. So why give up our lives for such a thing? But Daniel doesn't take such an excuse. He sees no reason to change his habit patterns. Anything else would demonstrate a lack of courage and a lack of character, a lack of faith in God. It's unthinkable to him. When all is said and done, of course, God spares Daniel. And his accusers are all thrown into the lion's den and consumed. Daniel winds up, I believe, in the job that Darius planned for him. We're not specifically told that, but we are told in verse 28, so Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. By the way, I can't help but contrast Daniel with a politician I got to know pretty well, not personally, but I knew him pretty well. He was the representative of the 3rd Congressional District in St. Louis for the whole 20 years that I was in St. Louis. His name was Dick Gephardt. He preceded Nancy Pelosi as the Democratic leader in the House of Representatives. When Dick Gephardt went to Congress in 1976, he was a pro-life, solid Southern Baptist. That's how he got elected in strongly Catholic St. Louis, is that he was pro-life. In fact, in 1984, he wrote these words, "Life is the division of human cells, a process that begins with conception. The Supreme Court's abortion ruling was unjust, and it is incumbent on the Congress to correct the injustice. I have always been supportive of pro-life legislation. I intend to remain steadfast on this issue. I believe that the life of the unborn should be protected at all costs." Less than 2 years later, in 1986, Dick Gephardt decided to run for president. He knew that he would never get the nomination in the Democrat Party as pro-life, so he switched. Not parties, convictions. And he became overnight strongly pro-choice, backing the most radical abortion legislation, even refusing to vote against partial birth abortion. Gephardt lost his bid for the nomination in 1988 and again in 2004. But more importantly, he lost his moral credibility, maybe even his soul. I have one more point I feel obligated to make, and that is caution. It's not always this neat and tidy. These 4 stories from the book of Daniel are pretty amazing, and they demonstrate how in the lives of these 4 men, courage and character always came before their careers. However, I don't want to lead you astray into thinking that God always responds with great blessing and stupendous miracles when we show courage and character. It's not guaranteed, friends. Turn with me for a moment to the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, which is the great hall of the faithful, as God lists the names of some of the great heroes of the Old Testament. People like Abraham and Moses and Rahab. And then in verse 32, as he's running out of time, he says, "And what more shall I say? I don't have time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Women received back their dead, raised to life again." It doesn't end there, friends. The next verse says, "Others were tortured and refused to be released so that they might gain a better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging, while still others were chained and put in prison. They were stoned, they were sawed in two, they were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains and in caves and holes in the ground." It would be dishonest to give you the impression that courage and character in the marketplace will always result in rescue and reward. It won't. But it's the right thing to do anyway. The very next phrase in Hebrews 11 says, These were all commended for their faith. Whether victor or victim, God commended them for their integrity, their courage, their faithfulness. Friends, I don't know what aspect of the marketplace you're in, whether it's a government employee, an educator, a businessman, someone in sales, whatever. God calls you to exhibit courage and character no matter what. More often than not, I believe it will lead to success, but sometimes it will lead to suffering and persecution. I call you to it anyway. This week I found a book about, well, it's entitled Eyes of the Tailless Animals, Prison Memoirs of a North Korean Woman. I don't recommend the book for those who have weak stomachs, but I want to read one section where Soon Ok Lee talks about her experience in the North Korean gulag. A communist herself, she was thrown into prison because she refused a graft that another official was asking for. And while in prison, she saw horrendous tortures and the murder of hundreds of Christians in the North Korean prisons. And she couldn't understand why they steadfastly refused to bend to the government's demands that they simply deny Christ. She later came to understand their steadfast faith when she escaped from North Korea and found the Lord in South Korea and then wrote this book. There's one particular section that reminds me of the story of the three young Hebrew men. It's entitled The Smelting Factory. It has a very different outcome, but it nevertheless presses home the theme of courage and character. She writes, "One night in February 1992, I went to the smelting factory. The work was almost done for the day and I had to check the daily production because that was my job. I saw 8 Christian prisoners carrying a big metal kettle holding molten iron. An officer called to them using very vile words. 'Tomorrow is a cleaning the mine day, he said. Tomorrow you will go out and tell everyone that there is nothing in heaven to believe in. There is no God. Otherwise you will be killed. Do you understand?' There was silence. Not one of the prisoners responded to the officer. He didn't wait long for an answer because he didn't like being ignored. He knew that tomorrow was an important day for re-education and he wanted the believers to recant. He yelled at the prisoners, 'Why are you so quiet? Answer me! Answer me now!' No one said a word. The officer became furious and began to curse at the men. At the top of his voice, he screamed, 'All 8 of you come here and put your face to the ground!' They came just as he ordered. They sat on their knees and then bent their heads down. The officer called over other male prisoners. 'We cannot let these men live. They think they don't know who I am. Bring boiling liquid iron from the furnace and pour it on them.' The male prisoners' faces were full of fear. The liquid iron was 1,200 degrees. They hesitated to do this terrible thing. The officer gave them a fierce scowl. 'Do you want to die with them?' The frightened prisoners ran to get a kettle of molten iron. Then they poured the boiling iron on top of the people of God, kneeling so quietly. Suddenly the smell of burning flesh assailed my nostrils. The bodies began to shrivel from the intense heat as the liquid metal burned right through their flesh and bones. I fell to the ground and almost fainted from shock. The impact on me was so tremendous that I screamed as if I were crazy. Other prisoners in the factory screamed in horror as the 8 Christians died. I looked at their shrunken bodies and wondered in my heart, what do they believe? What do they see in the empty sky? What could be more important to them than their lives? In the years I was in prison, I saw many believers die. Yet they never, never denied the God who is in heaven. All they had to do was say they don't believe in religion, and they would have been released. I didn't understand what made them not fear. Their unbelievable faith brought a big question into my heart. What did they see? And what am I missing? Well, the answer to her questions is found in the next verse in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1. It says, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, the Daniels, the Shadrachs, Meshachs, Abednegoes, the unnamed prisoners in North Korea, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. And let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men so that you will not grow weary and lose heart." Could you pray with me?